Ultrasound Gel Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Ultrasound Gel Podcast. I'm Jacob Avila, and I am joined by Cray Bolger and Mike Bratz. How are you guys doing?
Hello.
Good morning.
Doing well. Reasonably well.
Yes, that is an amazing segue into our study today. A retrospective study of pulseless electrical activity, bedside ultrasound identifies interventions during resuscitation associated with improved survival to hospital admission, a recent study. That's kind of a mouthful, but it's okay because it's some very interesting data. So this was in 2017 in resuscitation. So what this is a secondary analysis of the REASON trial. That was a study of about 20 different centers in which they took the ultrasound before and during cardiac arrest patients following down that ACLS algorithm and basically tried to see what they could find. And what they did here briefly is they took the ultrasounds that were done and looked specifically at the ones that were PEA. And within those PEA, they separated them into those that had cardiac activity, basically, and the ones that didn't have good cardiac activity. And the good cardiac activity was defined as basically any ventricular squeeze, and the bad cardiac activity was no organized movement of that myocardium, basically. And they wanted to look at what associations those had with things like ROSC and things like survival to discharge.
That sounds good to me. And just to note that their primary outcome, as in their original study, was the survival to hospitalization. So, Cray, how did they do this study?
So they were looking at the REASON data and did the secondary analysis, as Jacob said, and looked at if these this crew got normal ACLS interventions or outside of ACLS interventions. One example of which was continuous ionotropy. Ionotropes. Drugs. Lots of drugs. And they looked at if there was ROSC and then the outcomes associated, like survival to discharge, as you said. And they tried to keep it nice and clean and crisp. So squeeze or no squeeze, and then organized or disorganized. So intermittent ventricular twitching, or did it look like something that could be reasonably perfusing, essentially. These were also reviewed by two blinded interpreters who confirmed or negated the bedside interpretation.
And I liked the definition that they used for organized cardiac activity. I felt like maybe this is something that we can carry forward. They defined it as movement of the myocardium with change in size of the ventricular cavity and synchronized movement of the ventricular wall.
I like that.
So basically, is the size getting smaller with these contractions as opposed to just little quivers or twitches? And does it look like everything's kind of moving together in some sort of synchronized rhythm?
Right. I agree. I think we've talked about this before, but it's really hard to decide what you're going to hang your hat on in a code. Just that little valve motion, some kind of twitch here or there. So I like this definition as well. Back to the study. The studies were performed by credentialed emergency medicine attendings. These were not just performed by the experts. It was whoever was available at the bedside. And they did a cardiac ultrasound during arrest. Mike, you want to tell us about what they found?
Sure. So for the results here, basically they ended up analyzing 225 patients. And out of those 170, they were able to tell, is it organized or disorganized? Just to get a feel for the population, about 55.5% of these got return of spontaneous circulation, but only 1.8% ultimately survived to hospital discharge. Their primary outcome of hospital admission, that was about 32%. And breaking it down to see how these people looked on ultrasound, well, about a third of them had organized activity, 42 had disorganized activity, and then there was a significant proportion of people where they couldn't tell if it was organized or disorganized, so 24.4%. And that's important going forward because they're trying to make the distinction between these two etiologies, or I guess these two sonographic phenotypes. And if you can't make that distinction all the time, then maybe that is a little bit limited in how well you can use it. So let's get down to the comparisons they're making, because this is where the article can sometimes throw you a little bit. They were looking at four different groups, basically, because each person had two different decision points. First, it was, did they have organized or disorganized activity on ultrasound? Then secondly, they broke it into, did this person get drugs by the book, by ACLS, or did the person go rogue and start some other medication? And in their case, the one they were most interested in was, did they get IV drips of inotropes? So they seem to want to single that one out, one, because it was one of the more common interventions, but also because they thought that could be responsible for a change in outcomes. So with those different options, keep in mind there's about four different groups you could be in, whether depending on which way you went on those two decision points. Let me get down to the main results now. So people with organized cardiac activity did have better survival than those with disorganized cardiac activity on ultrasound. And that held true for both the ACLS and the non-ACLS group. Now within the organized cardiac activity group, people that had non-ACLS medications actually had a better survival than those that only received ACLS medications. And then, if you go on the other side into the disorganized activity group, there was really no significant difference between the groups whether they got ACLS or non-ACLS groups. And a very important result is that there was no difference in any group of survival to discharge. And keeping in mind, that was their secondary outcome, because their primary outcome was survival to hospitalization. Mm-hmm. So if you think about all this stuff, sure, it's important that we can do something or find something that we know people are going to survive to hospitalization. But one of the main criticisms of the original REASON trial was that, one, their primary outcome was survival to hospitalization instead of survival to discharge. And secondly, that there was no mention of neurologic outcomes. So we don't know if these people are surviving with any sort of functional status. So that's the main result. There's a ton of other numbers and things that we can talk about here. But what do you guys take away from this? What else do you think is worth noting about this paper?
Well, for me, I mean, this is not necessarily going to change my practice necessarily, but I'm still happy that it was published. Let me explain. So basically, if I have a patient and they're in PEA, but I see organized rhythm on that ultrasound, that either the initial ultrasound or the initial sounds that are done during pulse checks, that definitely makes me think that the patient has a heart that, if given a little more inotropy, a little more support, might have a higher likelihood of surviving at least to ROSC, right? The other thing that I thought was kind of cool was that they demonstrated an association. That's not necessarily causality, but an association between patients who were placed on continuous adrenergic drips versus the boluses. Because that's something that I tend to do as well. If I have a patient that seems like they have ejection fractions, they have an EF of like 5 or 10%, I often will put them on epi drips or norepinephrine drips, to kind of help with that. And so this is kind of showing that at least I'm not the only person that's doing this, and physiologically it makes sense. The only thing, we were talking about it, the only thing that we got to kind of be careful with is that these confidence intervals are super wide, and this is a little bit of like data mining as well. So this isn't saying that the standard of care is to do those things, but I'm happy because I haven't actually come across any other articles that address these questions. So at least they're bringing the questions up, and hopefully this spurs more interest into looking at prospective studies that are done specifically to answer those questions.
Yeah, I agree with that, Jacob. I think that this really does make you think about this. The authors concluded that patients with organized cardiac activity respond better to standard ACLS interventions, and also that patients with organized cardiac activity may respond differently to medications like continuous intravenous vasopressors. And I think that's fine to say, but there's a lot of ifs in there. So we don't know that this is for sure. This is really interesting, and this is very informative for future research endeavors. But it's hard to draw definitive conclusions from this because of those limitations that you mentioned, and especially with a lot of the comparisons that they're making, the confidence intervals did overlap.
I think one thing I really like about this is we haven't seen any progression outside of hands-only CPR in ACLS in a long time. And I think for many of us practicing who are kind of going outside the box, we know that other things probably work better, and we're struggling to find something that works, because there's some of these people, especially when you see that fairly organized cardiac activity, that you feel like there's something inside that's salvageable. And so I think that that's one great thing from this study, is it kind of opens that box a little bit more and says maybe we can look at some alternative means of assessing and resuscitating these people. And I think also them defining that organized activity and really trying to put another branch point in the algorithm is huge. As we've talked about before on the podcast, I think a lot of people stand there and stare at the screen trying to decide, is it something real or not, and potentially waste time off the chest, and I don't want to say give ultrasound a bad name, but maybe aren't using it as efficiently as they could during CPR. And I think this maybe gives you a record and look for A, not A, B, or C, right? So organized or not, it has to meet these criteria, versus any flutter, flicker, twitch counts for something. I think this really helps make that branch point much better defined. And I think their outcomes, while big confidence intervals and why a lot of assumptions and not direct causality, I think bring some clarity to that situation.
Yeah, and I think that's the way that a lot of medicine is going. We're going to more personalized care instead of cookbook, everybody gets the same thing to them. You know, we see that in a lot of other pathology that we take care of. And so why shouldn't it be the same with cardiac arrest? And I think that's why they're saying, hey, ultrasound is a tool that can be used to more specifically define what's going on with your patient so that you can tailor care to their actual body and not just, you know, a general, they're in arrest, let's do the same thing every time. So I think that this is really an interesting idea, and this is at least a little bit of evidence that, hey, maybe this is going to actually help some people with real outcomes. Now, guys, one thing that I would be a little concerned about, you know, we just did a paper not too long ago about the variability in cardiac standstill. Do you think that it would be a variability in determining who has organized and disorganized rhythm on ultrasound?
Possibly. I mean, I think that for me, there are definitely going to be cases where I'm like, I don't know, maybe that's organized activity, maybe not. But for me, if I see that where I'm like not 100% sure if it's actually squeezing, I'm just going to assume that it's not squeezing. If it's like that subtle. And so, I mean, for me, basically, it's pretty black and white. Like either that is a squeeze or it's not a squeeze. And if there's like an area where I'm kind of gray, I just push that over towards not squeezing. That I can't speak for everybody. And that's just kind of like my subjective way of reasoning through it. So I don't have those gray areas.
I agree. I think if it's a twitch or a flicker, right, it's probably nothing. So if you had to look twice, stare at it, spend more than 10 seconds looking at it, it's probably not something meaningful. I like to tell the residents, would you want your heart to do that? And if it's no, keep doing chest compressions.
That's good. So I guess the end of the day, is this going to change anything that you do?
No, but it reinforces what I already do. So it like makes me feel good about what I've been doing, but it's not necessarily going to change anything. That being said, I'm not saying that because I think that this is like a useless paper. Like I'm really happy that this paper is out there. But mostly I'm happy about it because it confirms what I've already been doing. So it makes me feel cool about myself, and it's all about me. So.
You do need that confidence boost from time to time.
I agree. I think it does open up the box, though, for a change in ACLS, and maybe reaffirming what most EPs know is that ACLS is for people who don't run codes on a regular basis, that diverting from the algorithm probably has some benefit and probably needs to be studied more.
Yeah, I think, and I think it's good to think about diverting as long as you know what you're doing. Like, don't divert just because you want to be cool.
Those are great points, guys. Let me just summarize this study and talk about some points we can take home. So this is a secondary analysis of a previously done prospective trial, and you can see our other show notes for the full methods on that recent trial. They ended up having 225 patients that they analyzed. They were comparing between those that had organized cardiac activity on ultrasound versus those that had disorganized cardiac activity, and then within those subgroups, who got ACLS medications and who got other medications outside of the ACLS algorithm. And what they found was that organized cardiac activity had better survival. Within the organized cardiac activity group, the non-ACLS group had better survival than the ACLS group. And there were no difference in any group's survival to discharge, which was a secondary outcome. So the take-home points that I got from this is that this is the first time it's been shown that differentiating organized and disorganized cardiac activity with point-of-care ultrasound is feasible. So I think that is a big point from this article. And then secondarily, this distinction can influence the survival in these patients. But again, this is just preliminary data. There's a lot of limitations to it, so it's kind of hypothesis generating for the future. I do want to thank the authors for this article. Really fantastic work they're doing, and I hope to see more papers out from this group. Thanks to you for listening to our podcast. Remember, you can go to our website at ultrasoundgel.org where you can sign up for a mailing list, and feel free to tweet us or look at us on Facebook and Google+. We'll be happy to talk to you. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you later.
More pressure, more gel, more pressure, more gel, more
ultrasound gel podcast.
Oh, that's so strong.